Hi, everyone, and welcome to part two of Mark and Patrick's conversation. And as always, for any questions about what Mark and Patrick have discussed today, please contact your financial advisor.
All right, Patrick, so now we're on to co-invest. You have both regular co-invest and then you have leverage co-invest. So why would a family office use a leverage co-invest versus a carried interest?
Yeah, I think there's a few different reasons why sometimes families use co-invest either in lieu of or often like in addition to some type of carry structure, because you see these two occurring quite a bit together. I think one of the reasons why some families and some in teams as well, but sometimes this comes more from the family, is a concern that a pure carry, you know, doesn't have any downside alignment, right? As we, I think, talked about, you get a share of the gains and the upside, but if it goes to zero, you never get less than zero. Whereas a co-invest involves the individual, you know, putting some of their own money in the deal, either out of pocket or sometimes with some type of loan from the family. So there's, I think, arguably a lot of families think there's more alignment because it's not just participating in the upside of the deal, but there's also potential real economic loss, which might act as a, avoid some like sort of moonshot opportunities if the individual family, you know, the investment professional has skin in the game or potentially downside. So I oftentimes see both carry and co-invest because maybe you have a carry on like the entire portfolio, but if there's a particular deal that somebody sourced or it's an industry that they know of, you know, there's an ability for employees to put money in a specific direct investment, for example.
Okay. So they could be used together. They're not exclusive. You see the pairing of a carry with a co-invest because it really enhances alignment. Let's talk. So if we're on a leverage co-invest, let's talk about potential forgiveness of the loan in the future. What do those dynamics look like?
Yeah, I guess I'll just tell you my perspective on it. I think there's a desire for employees to come out of pocket, usually with some piece of their co-invest, but there's also a desire to give them, you know, loan proceeds. So they put in 50 grand, the family loans them 150, and they've got the $200,000 investment, right? 1/4 just out of pocket and 3/4 on debt. I think for it to be respected as debt for tax purposes, you can have a plan to sort of forgive the loan. It's got to be, you know, really got to be respected as debt for tax purposes. That said, a lot of principals, I think, are quite reluctant, especially when they hear, you know, usually we structure this debt as recourse debt, meaning the collateral is not just the investment itself, but is a general obligation of the employee. And there's tax and non-tax reasons for a recourse versus a non-recourse or partial recourse debt. But there is a reluctance to think, oh, like, well, I don't want to take their house, you know, that sort of thing. So I think there is the possibility if it's a situation where there's a default or the deal, you know, goes to zero or something, the family could just forgive the debt in the future. Now that would be income, right? That would be COD, so that the employee would have to pay tax, but it would be a way to de-risk the employee in the future. But I typically don't think of that as like the real plan, you know, like that could be something that could be decided at the time, but I think the plan and expectation would be that the loan would be repaid. But there's some flexibility to do that in the future.
Okay. So along the same line, so, you know, you've got debt and then you've got maturity. And what happens if at maturity the investment is underwater or really still far from it, from an exit or realization? What are some of the options there?
Yeah, so I guess, simply put, there's one option would be to just call the loan. I mean, usually, and this is something that I've seen go the other way, but I think it's important for employees not to become over-levered, right, where they can only borrow something that they could repay if it really came to it. But that's one thing. So you could simply call the loan at maturity. Another thing that you could do is you could just, the parties could agree to extend the maturity date, which I think is probably the most common situation because, again, the loan was meant to be a benefit to the employee to begin with. So they're not looking to, like, necessarily have them sell their investment portfolio to repay the debt. So the parties could extend it. I guess they could also forgive it at that time, as we talked about in a second ago. Or a lot of times in these structures, sometimes there's the ability to basically monetize through a call or a put, either the employee's co-invest position or their carry position. So you could see a world where maybe their co-invest on deal number two, Mark, is underwater, but the employee has a big carry on their private equity fund of funds. So you might be able to say, okay, well, I've got an idea. Let's just mark to market the private equity fund portfolio and pay out your carry to allow you to de-risk on them and pay down the loan on the co-invest. So, I mean, normally that's one of the cool things about working with family offices is they can sort of do whatever they want, right? So they, and usually these are in situations where they're really getting along with the employee. The employee is very valuable. So usually it's the family that wants to get creative about how to help out. Obviously some family offices act more like third party arrangements and it's more commercial, but in my experience, most of the time, people sort of put on their thinking caps and want to think through how to protect the employee, frankly. So I think you can do a number of different things to deal with that situation.
Okay, perfect. And then we get into, you know, just the tax benefits of using a co-invest structure. Can you talk briefly about that?
Yeah, I think I talked earlier about carry. I mean, There's a very strong position, I think, under most fact patterns that a carry would give somebody capital gain treatment, even if it's a 1 to 3 year holding period. I know that's a hyper technical tax rule, but, and then there's also getting qualified small business stock treatment for carry. So there's lots of potential, but some of those positions are not totally certain. If you use a co-invest, so let's say I borrow money on a recourse basis to invest in a deal, it's very, very clear. There's actually a clear regulation that just says that those carried interest rules do not apply to me. And so there's a clear path to capital gain treatment, qualified small business stock treatment, the ability to deduct state taxes against federal using entities. So the tax benefits are much clearer, I'd say, in a co-invest structure, but I wouldn't concede that a lot of those benefits can't be realized in a carry structure. But the rules are just clearer in co-invest.
Okay. And then sort of the catch-all, what are really the potential downsides or challenges to using a co-invest structure?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big downsides is one of the reasons why some families and principals like it, which is the economic exposure on the employee, right? It really, especially if you're using leverage that's recourse, I mean, it really does create economic risk, which is, again, arguably why it creates maximum alignment. But that would be a real potential challenge economically to the employee. If their carry just gives them upside, we can talk about phantom equity in a second. Again, there's usually no out-of-pocket loss there, economic loss, but there's the economic difference. And then the other challenge to a co-invest structure, which is a good segue into the phantom, is that if you are co-investing in like a big pooled vehicle that invests in private equity funds, right? Co-invest means you actually hold equity for tax purposes, so you would get a K-1. You would have state, federal, international tax filings, quarterly estimated payments, the need for tax distributions. Like, depending on what the asset is or are, the tax compliance can actually be very complicated in any type of equity structure, whether it's carry or co-invest. And then the other thing is, I think some employees think, well, co-invest is great, but that shouldn't be a substitution for carry or a bonus, right? Like, because that's just putting me on the same shoulder to shoulder with the family investors, but it doesn't account necessarily for all the services and all the value that I've added. So that's why, again, it's sometimes, but oftentimes it's paired with other strategies.
Okay. And so you know, you mentioned Phantom Equity. So we covered carry, we just covered co-invest, and let's get to Phantom Equity. Can you briefly talk about Phantom Equity and when and where you might see this more often than really the other two strategies?
Yeah, so let me just quickly define it. So Phantom Equity, I think, is a broad term where ultimately what we're talking about is some type of formula that pays W-2 compensation to the employee. So this is not actual equity for tax purposes. They're getting a bonus that's based on usually some type of investment returns of an underlying set of portfolio investments. So instead of putting in $100,000 of real money into a partnership and getting a K-1, I can put $100,000 of my bonus or my comp, or the family can sort of set aside a notional amount that gets paid out, let's say, in 5 or 10 years that tracks the performance of one and more investments that the family owns. So it gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of defining the award, and it doesn't force the family to put all the assets in the same entity to do a carry. So some of the assets may be in a charitable trust, some of them may be in a foundation, some of them may be in an offshore vehicle or offshore trust or a domestic trust. Like any type of carry or co-invest, you actually have to situate the assets legally, right, where the employee can come in on equity. If you're just drafting a contract, which is what a phantom plan is, it's just a compensatory contract, you're able to define it very flexibly. And then also another reason why I see people consider doing phantom is it avoids all of the compliance, tax compliance, and legal complexity of having outright ownership and all the K-1s and the state filings, et cetera, tax distributions. You just put it in a notional account, it tracks the underlying performance, and then it gets paid out as W-2 comp with withholding. The reason why it's good, that simplicity and the fact that there's no tax compliance kind of like carry and co-invest, is one of the reasons why people don't use it, which is that it always comes out to the employee as ordinary income, subject to, you know, state and applicable, federal and applicable state taxes. It also, you can't get a deduction for the state taxes under the SALT, you know, cap, right? Whereas in a co-invest or carry, you can usually deduct state taxes by paying them through an entity. Another disadvantage to Phantom is because it's a contractual right based on services, you can't really do estate planning with it if you're an employee, right? You have a compensatory award. It is what it is. Whereas if you have a carry or co-invest, it's possible to do some estate planning if you're an employee. So there's definitely some drawbacks to using a phantom plan, but under the right situation, it might make sense for the family to try to, quote, keep it simple and do sort of a bonus plan, but that tracks the underlying investment returns.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So it could make sense, the phantom equity could make sense in the right context, and then you just have to look at the trade-offs. And then obviously, like we said earlier, really just model out the potential upside as well as the downside within the overall context of the employee's comp, so everybody's on the same page. So,
yeah.
So, you know, when we're talking about comp, you know, we're talking about, hey, how do we set these up when the employee, right, at sort of at the outset oftentimes, but not always, of the employee's employment, right? So they're joining the family office, you're setting this up. But what are some of the issues related to the termination of employment, right, within the context of these structures? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think this is sometimes these conversations can be uncomfortable generally. You know, sometimes a lot of really great family office employees are uncomfortable advocating for themselves or don't like to be seen as opportunists to their families. So sometimes these conversations generally don't happen but it's also can be particularly hard sometimes to talk about what happens if you leave, right? What happens if you're fired for cause, without cause, die, become disabled, you know, voluntary resignation. So I think it's really important to talk up front about all those scenarios, basically. And I have a bit of a phrase that I say that I'm not in the business of protecting former employees. And what I mean by that is, and it's literally true that, you know, my client is almost never the employees. It's usually the family or the family office. And the whole point of all these things are to get good people to stay and attract good people, right? And so the exit provisions, what happens if I leave? Yes, it is important to think about that. And it's sometimes employees will not join unless they have some type of good exit provision. But generally, I like to give the family the ability to call, you know, to basically repurchase an employee's co-investor carry. Oftentimes, if they leave for any reason, sometimes that gets negotiated, whether, you know, good leaver, bad leaver provisions. But what I have seen that's not great is if there's no ability to take somebody out when they leave, they're holding carry, they're holding their co-invest in perpetuity. Oftentimes that creates less dry powder for the people that stayed behind, right? Or the next CFO or CIO that you're going to hire. And so it sort of like blocks the sun. So I think there's a lot of reasons to think on the front end about how to exit people if they separate from service. And I tend to be very kind of pro-family on that because I've just seen the effect of not having call options or forfeiture provisions if someone's fired for cause, et cetera. And again, those are tough conversations sometimes to have, but I think if you figure out what you're trying to protect, which is the culture of the family office and the family, those issues can often be settled very quickly. But it is sometimes hard if you find yourself in an existing plan where there's no vesting, let's say, or there's no forfeiture, or there's no call rights, et cetera. It can be hard to then introduce some of these termination provisions, as you can imagine, if the team hasn't had them for 20 years. So, and it is oftentimes new joiners, Mark, but a lot of times these structures are in the middle of a team that's been there for a long time, but maybe just has never had a co-investor carry. So, you know, I guess my thing is you've got to just have open and honest professional conversations about these things, and we're usually able to get to a good answer for everybody. But usually it involves some type of call or forfeiture of carry and or co-invest. And it's rarely the case that the employee, even if they quit and go join another family office or whatever, can just hold on to these equity instruments perpetually. That's, I'd say, the exception rather than the rule.
Yeah. All right. Good advice. So moving along a bit, so, you know, you had mentioned CFO, CIO. And so that's to my next question is, you know, you've got a team at a family office, and if you're offering these types of benefits or incentives, you're probably a larger family office, although, you know, maybe not all the time. And so what is the really the pool of employees look like for this key staff? You know, do you see it more widely used with just investment professionals, or are you seeing it, you know, anecdotally with, you know, the broader key staff, such as CFOs, general counsels, so on and so forth?
Yeah, I would say anecdotally, I'm seeing a trend of expanding the participants in these programs beyond investment professionals, for sure. Typically, it would be the non-investment executive suite. So like your general counsel, your CFO, your president that may or may not be and have an investment background. But I think there's in some families a perception that, well, why should the investment team sort of get all of the equity here, because it's oftentimes the tax director, the GC, the CFO that's doing tons of the work, both on like the diligence, but also the administration of these. And so there's a belief that culturally, you know, they don't want people feeling like they're not sharing in the wealth, so to speak, especially if there's big payouts to the investment team. It's very, very driven by culture and really the specific people, because not all, as you know, not all family office people have clear titles and roles. You know, a lot of people do a lot of different things. There's not always such a key delineation between investment and non-investment or executive or administrative. I mean, people have dynamic roles. So I do see a trend of expanding the plan from inception or midstream into non-investment executives. There's definitely an SEC question, especially with co-invest, but really all of these strategies, about whether you can include non-investment non-executives. And I'm not sure if you talked about the single family office rule on any of your other podcasts, but that's sort of a side note, that it's important to run all these plans through the SEC lens. And the bottom line is oftentimes it's sometimes hard to include non-executive, non-investment professionals in some type of plan. You might be able to do it as a bonus plan, but some of these structures, the SEC rules might come up and say, well, this person is not a permitted investor and stay within the SEC exemption for single family offices. So that's kind of a side note, but it's important, and it can sometimes prevent expanding beyond sort of the executive.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense within the context of the rule. You know, it's usually, I think, limited to key employees. But just to take a step back, and I believe we talked about this earlier, you know, whichever form of compensation the family office chooses, could you give us a high-level process that the family office should really engage in before setting up these structures? You know, just broadly speaking, what is the ideal process look like?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of pieces to it. Let me start with like what's maybe not a great process, which is just calling, you know, a friend who's also another billionaire and asking them what they do and assuming that's the right thing for you. I think that's probably not ideal. I think it's important to have some type of benchmarking to overall comp for your geographic region and your footprint as a family office. There's a lot of good consultants and, you know, publications on benchmarking. I think it's really, really important to understand what you're trying to accomplish. Like, what are we trying to do? Are we just reacting because that's what we think we should do? Or what are our actual goals and objectives? I think people like you can be part of that conversation. We sometimes are part of it. There's other advisors. I think it's important for the family and the team to have open and honest conversations. I've seen sometimes these negotiations get really protracted and frankly uncomfortable and nasty. So I think it's important just to go in with like a really open perspective on all sides and hear each other out. I mean, I personally don't advise clients like, oh, well, you should pay somebody X or they should get 5% or 10%. Like those to me are business terms that benchmarking might help, but even benchmarks can be unreliable or frankly just not applicable because you're not bound to any of that. So I guess to me, the most important thing is like, what are we actually trying to achieve?
Yeah.
Are we trying to create stickiness? Are we trying to just attract this person? Are we trying to provide them with liquidity? Is liquidity important? Is it just value accretion over time? Like these, so you really just have to kind of get to know the employees' personal situations and the family's objectives, and then really understand the portfolio as well. Because they may say, well, we want to give this person carry on this asset that's in a private foundation. And like, so dealing with kind of the structural hurdles it depends on, you know, the exact dynamic and culture, but I think it's important to really understand why are we doing this. And generally the reason what you're doing it is to create maximum alignment and to compensate great people for great decisions. But for example, what are great decisions? What's a great economic outcome? Is you could say, well, I got 5% returns for 10 years, but what if the market is down 20% a year over that same time? right? Is it growth or is it relative to a benchmark? So like thinking about what the goals are is the most important thing. And then I guess my two cents is to try to have these negotiations quickly rather than protracted, because I think the more time goes on, the more this can become an exhausting conversation for all sides and people can get frustrating. Where I've seen to be most successful is where there's radical transparency, there's modeling the economic outcomes so that everyone has full visibility, and then there's quickly just knocking off the points, like the termination of employment stuff, the non-core economic terms, and just trying to get to a meeting in the minds quickly and getting it done so that they can get back to the business of investing rather than being stuck in what can be an uncomfortable discussion if it draws on and on, which I've seen happen multiple times, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, I usually advise, because I get the question, like, what's the size, how should we size the carry? And I said, listen, I can't really advise you on that. What I would say is to take a step back and think about your goals and objectives within the overall context of the reality of the family office, which is usually the portfolio, at least for these conversations, and come up with a comp policy. Because if you're going to commit it to paper and write it down, you're probably going to think about this just in a broader, big picture environment rather than, hey, let's just talk about the size of the carrier or the size of the co-investment leverage that we're going to give you. So perfect. Okay. So Patrick, one last thing, before we get out of here today, is there anything that we haven't covered that you would want to leave, the listeners with here?
Yeah. I mean, I think I touched on it, but I think what's most important to me is just how personal this all is, like the human and the emotional element. It's really, really important. Now, are there some family offices that are all just, arm's length commercial actors? Sure. The vast, vast majority of people, when you're talking about their comp, it's not just dollars and cents. It's their perceived value. It's behaviors. And so I think just being very human in how you think about this, transparent, kind, listening, I think that's really, really important stuff, because you are ultimately trying to define through dollars somebody's, value to the family. And that's a very delicate thing. And so that's my big take home, is just these conversations can be very delicate, even if somebody's a highly, astute and successful family office executive, they're people at the end of the day, and they have feelings and they can feel hurt or disappointed. And it sounds like I'm an armchair. I mean, well, I'm sure you are as well, Mark, but just the human element of this and really trying to figure out what you're accomplishing and is really, really important, because a lot of people's value at a family office has nothing to do with the investment returns.
Completely agree.
It has nothing to do with, integrating the next gen or being on some special project that's philanthropically based. So not reducing somebody's value to these dollars and cents, but also having a system that is, transparent and works for everybody, because that's really what you're trying to do. But I think it's important to always keep that larger, kind of trust and people dynamic in mind as you have these conversations, or else it can go very, it can go to a rocky place if you don't get that tone right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I mean, I always make the analogy that families were really the original B Corps. Like, yeah, they want a return, but there's a lot of other factors that they care about, right? And, with the family office, I mean, these are people that they're dealing with every day. And so the people part of it is a really big thing, often because of that reason, right? It's the family name is on the door. They're dealing with the entire family and not just, one individual family most times. So that makes complete sense.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, this is great. I mean, so before we conclude, Patrick, I want to thank you for your time. For our listeners, I hope you found the conversation valuable. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to your UBS financial advisor or Patrick McCurry at McDermott. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Thank you.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.